This week on the Vergecast, we talk about everything that happened at Adobe Max. The new Microsoft Surface Pro X came out. Microsoft Ignite happened. And we talk about what is going on with missed text messages showing up from Valentine's Day. That's all coming up on the Vergecast now.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at Deloitte.com/US/engineering advantage.
Hi, we're Visible, the wireless company with nothing to hide. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not into you. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Hello and welcome to Vergecast, the flagship podcast of the ever-growing Vox Media Empire. Someone's going to eventually talk to us about that. I can just feel it. The company's getting bigger.
Yeah.
Someone's going to be like, Neil, you have to stop that. But not today.
Today, we are still the flagship podcast of the situation.
Today, yeah, the situation. There are basically 2 weeks of news here. A lot going on. First of all, I'm your friend, Neil.
Hi, Neil.
That other voice is Dieter Bohn.
I'm here.
Paul Miller is here.
Hello.
Dami Lee is here.
Yo.
How's it going, Dami?
Good.
You're back from L.A.?
Just flew in. Boy, my arm's tired.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God.
It's already off the rails. There's a lot going on. We basically have 2 weeks of news.
We're not going to get it all. Like, there's stuff that's just hitting the floor.
Yeah. We actually just made a bunch of cuts. But I want to start with something new, I think, for The Verge in general. So, Dami, you just came back from Adobe Max.
Yeah.
Basically, we created a team of people who cover, like, the creator sphere about a year ago, somewhere around there. And so, like, we have Julia on to talk about, like, YouTubers. And sometimes we have Ashley on to talk about Instagrammers. But a thing that we noticed is that all of these creators have their own monopoly problem, basically, which is that everyone in this industry is reliant on Adobe. It's this huge company. I think it's a little bit undercovered.
Yeah. I mean, basically every YouTuber uses like Premiere to edit their videos. Every Instagrammer is using Photoshop or Lightroom to make their photos look great. Every artist out there is using Photoshop or, you know, Illustrator. So Adobe Max is this huge creativity conference that they have every year. And it's basically the only place in the world where you can get a room of 15,000 people all cheering for a selection tool or content-aware fill. I mean, the air was...
Why have we not gone there
before? The air was electric. Like, people were... People were going nuts. Like, they would announce something on stage and they'd be like, yeah, like, we love Sensei, which is like their AI platform, which basically is in like every single thing they announced this week. So they announced like the big one, which is Photoshop for iPad. And they announced that they're bringing Illustrator to the iPad. Like, they announced like 15 different things. So there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
Is it like a bunch of like engineers? Is it a bunch of creative people? Is it a bunch of nerds? Is it all of the above? Like, what's the crowd like?
Pretty much. So a lot of designers, and the conference is open to anybody, but, you know, it's like really expensive. Tickets, I think, are like 300 or more. So it's basically companies that are like sending teams of designers to go and like learn stuff. They have workshops, and it's like really global too. Like, I saw a lot of like foreign press and like people being fed like the Japanese translations of like what was going on the stage. So yeah, just like a ton of people all packed into like the LA conference, like the convention center.
Yeah.
Why was John Mulaney there?
So
that was very confusing.
That is a part of an annual event they do called Sneaks, where they preview a bunch of like experimental new features that are coming. So I think they previewed Adobe Fresco there last year, and they always have a celebrity host. So last year, I think it was like Tiffany Haddish, and this year they had John Mulaney, and it's kind of like I think it's a like 6 p.m. or so, and so they're like handing out drinks and like getting people like excited about these new features that could probably like take over their jobs later at some point. So it's kind of like buttering them up. It's like, hey, we got this cool celebrity host. Like, this is a fun event. Like, no worries here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you wrote a whole post based on the one that can detect like image manipulation.
Yeah. So there's a lot of AI features like that. So there's one that's really cool or scary, depending on how you look at it, where you can it can track your body movements. So it sees like the subject in a video and it automatically generates like 18 different body joints. So you can make a character animate like really fast and, you know, mirror your body movements. There's another one that might take Andrew's job. it just cleans up a lot of like background noise, or it can take out like all the ums and ahs like of your speech. So a lot of scary stuff out there.
Let's start with like the news, because the sneaks are really interesting and they kind of show where Adobe is going. Like once I think a company like Adobe hits that point of massive saturation in the industry, they can roll out a feature and then everyone, like it changes the nature of what we make.
Mm-hmm.
But the big one here is actually not new features. It's actually a much smaller set of features on the iPad, which is Photoshop on the iPad.
Yeah.
So when the iPad Pro was coming out, I think you had Photoshop for iPad. Adobe was like pre-releasing it. They gave you an exclusive. We had Scott Belsky on the podcast. We talked about it. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
It's out now. It's getting bad reviews in the App
Store.
Yeah.
Currently it's at a 2.3. And people are mad that it doesn't have a lot of basic features like the magic wand tool, which I got a lot of flack for when I did the video because I tried to Photoshop a sword into Carly Rae Jepsen's hand.
Like you do.
And yeah, and usually you would just do like a click of the magic wand button to like erase the background, but it didn't have that feature at the time. That's what we thought, like, oh, they're going to add it later. So like I just had to use the eraser tool and people were like, yeah, why aren't you using the magic wand tool? You're so dumb. And then it's like, it's not here on the final version. So They said that I talked to the Photoshop product manager and she said they are going to be much more aggressive with bringing updates to Photoshop on the iPad because it's mobile. So they're going to try to do it like maybe once a month. Yeah. So hopefully we'll see that feature coming soon. But a lot of people aren't happy that it's not like the exact desktop experience on the iPad.
There's the exact recreating all the features of Photoshop. And then there's the magic wand tool. Like, you know, like I understand that you can't bring all of Photoshop in one go. It's a lot of work. But doesn't that seem like it's one of those bare minimum features? Like what is Photoshop-y? I know you said in your write-up, you talk about how the code is coming from the real Photoshop. But are there features that make it feel like you have the real Photoshop?
They said they definitely focused on like the compositing workflows first. So on stage, they're like, we're going to bring in this mushroom from Adobe Stock and we're going to make it glow and we're going to put it in this forest. So it is good at like, you know, putting these pieces together, but it's not so good at other workflows like maybe illustration. So for that, they were like, why don't you try Fresco? That's our other app for illustration.
Wait, isn't the magic wand tool like really important in compositing work?
Right. So,
okay. So there's this whole debate about is this real Photoshop or not? It's based on the real code. But like with the USB port on the iPad, it's like, is it a real USB port until you can plug a USB drive into it and do something useful? The answer is no. It is not real.
Well, Dieter went straight to USB-C. I was not expecting that turn coming, but I definitely should have been.
Is it Photoshop if it doesn't have a magic wand tool? Is that the thing, or is there some other thing?
Well, so the thing they are focusing on are the cloud PSDs, which is you can basically start a file on the desktop, and then you can continue working on that same file in the iPad and vice versa. So that's the thing that they're focusing on first.
This is what I have been trying to like muddle towards is the cloud PSD is like the heart of this whole enterprise. And when they first announced Photoshop for iPad, they like half mentioned it to us. Now they're like, here it is. Like, here's the real deal. Like, you're going to run this real Photoshop on the iPad. But really the thing is it's going to use the same files that sync across Creative Cloud to your desktop and, I don't know, to your other devices in the future.
Right.
I'm just going to – that is ecosystem lock-in. You have to pay them forever to use this cloud file.
Right.
And you have no choice but to pay them however much they decide to charge for cloud storage. And last time I checked, Photoshop files not small.
Yeah. So the cloud PSDs are also really important because they are they're introducing new apps that kind of rely on these Photoshop files. So they also announced Adobe Aero, which is this like AR authoring app, and it basically uses layered PSD files. So it's like it's lets people make AR experiences like without knowing how to code, without knowing Unity. It's like all you need is Photoshop. And it's like, well, great. So now I have this Photoshop. I got to like rely on this to make this AR experience. And there's also a new app called Photoshop Camera. And that also uses Photoshop layers. So you can make filters for, you know, like Instagram or TikTok. So, yeah.
So it seems like there's two kind of big ideas here. One is related to the thing that we're always talking about, which is when are tablets going to just supersede laptops? And Dieter, you reviewed the Surface Pro X this week, so there's just a lot of lines converging here, right? So when are like mobile processor based tablets going to supersede sort of Intel laptops or Intel? It's there. And so one of the key apps in this world, in this conversation, is Photoshop, right? Like there's no way for a ton of creative people that you can switch to an iPad if Photoshop isn't there. So now you've got a thing that is called Photoshop and Adobe insists is real Photoshop, but it's like one quarter of Photoshop with a wacky new file format. And eventually they're going to build it out to be the whole thing.
It's at least one quarter of Photoshop that it's the same file when you're at your real Photoshop desk. So if you like get stuck, you don't have to do anything except turn on your computer and open Photoshop.
Yes,
so
the essence of the iPad experience is getting stuck and then opening your laptop and having the fan turn on and the battery die.
I brought this up a little bit ago, but I've been doing a lot of music stuff on the iPad. And music on the iPad is all about, with the exception of a couple apps that do everything all in one, most of the ecosystem, it is all about bopping from app to app. So like it makes sense, like I would work in Photoshop and then like I need kind of a drawing feature, I'll work on the same file in Fresco, or like now I need to make it AR. And so you know, but now it's not really ready for print and I want to work on it on my desktop, so then I jump over to, like for music on the iPad, a lot of people bounce something, they just use the iPad as sort of the place to be creative and free, and then you finish it on your desktop. I think that's a pretty common workflow. So it kind of makes sense with Adobe approaching it this way, but it is scary to have it be one Adobe file format instead of something that could be, interoperable.
Well, to be fair, the PSD file itself is not like a paradigm of interoperability.
Yeah.
Well,
you can also, you can open PSD files on, I think, is it Affinity?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about that. Like, I don't really dislike Adobe as a company, but I hate their stupid Creative Cloud app that takes over your computer and you can't uninstall.
Oh, but now it's an experience. Tommy wrote about this too.
Yeah.
Creative Cloud is no longer, it's like a social network now.
It's a whole thing now.
I have like Pixelmator on my Mac, but I don't really do a lot of photo stuff. I use Figma for vector and like design kind of stuff. And I use DaVinci Resolve for video editing. I've like tried to extricate myself from Adobe. I wonder if that's like I don't know if Adobe is afraid of that or if they're just like, we're so fun.
I mean, they are kind of already going after Figma now because Figma's whole thing of multiplayer editing, which lets people like work together on the same file. It's like they announced that same feature to Adobe XD. So Figma, you in danger, girl.
Okay, so that there's Photoshop and they know it's getting kind of trounced in reviews. They seem to be okay with it.
Yeah, so Scott Belsky tweeted today, it was like, the hardest journeys or...
Dear God.
Yeah. No. I mean, they know the first version is going to be, not the best. It's not going to get the best reviews. And I think for them, it's going to be a process. And I do believe them that when they say they're going to bring the Magic Wand tool, like in a couple months or whenever that might be. Personally, I do a lot of work where I like translate comics. So that's something that I can do on the iPad where I couldn't do before. It's like all I need to do is just like import fonts into the iPad and I can use like the text tool on Photoshop. So it's like a lot of little things like that that I can like do on a plane, like on the go, that I would use this for. I don't think I would use Photoshop on the iPad for like drawing because I don't do that on the iPad to begin with. I use my computer.
So I was actually going to ask you about that. So how much of your creative workflow with your comics, like could you move to the iPad or would you want to do on the iPad? It sounds like a little bit here or there, but like fundamentally Adobe hasn't convinced you to like throw your computer away.
Right. See, like I wouldn't use Photoshop on iPad at all for drawing comics because I've never used the iPad for drawing comics. Like I've tried Procreate and it's really hard for me to just like switch up my workflow. But yeah, like the thing with translating text, like that I can see myself using Photoshop for.
So they also announced Illustrator. So they announced Photoshop ages ago. It's out now. It's Scott Belsky. I like Scott. He was like on our show. I hope we have him again. He's fun to talk to. He is a thought leader. And sometimes he tweets like a thought leader. And he's like, the journey just beginning. Mobile is a new dawn. Mm-hmm. Like, Okay, so they're on the journey. But then they also announced Illustrator.
Yeah.
Which is obviously the other big app and like mm-hmm. the duo of Adobe apps. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be the same cut down thing? Are they going to, is it going to have a magic wand tool?
It's going to have, it's the same concept where you can take the same Illustrator file and open up on the desktop and continue working on it. I do think, so I got like a preview of it, and I do think that people are going to be a lot happier with Illustrator when it launches on day one than they were with Photoshop, because I don't think there's, like, the only important thing in Illustrator is the pen tool, and that, like, the demonstration we saw was, like, very impressive. It looked complete. It's got all these features where it uses AI where to take a photo, you can import a photo of, like, a sketch that you did, and then it automatically, like, creates these paths, and you don't have to, like, add anything to it, or you can, like, tweak it if you want, but it for someone like me who doesn't use Illustrator on the desktop, the iPad version just looked a lot easier to use for beginners, and they've just like simplified the UI, so it's just like anyone with an Apple Pencil could like probably learn to use it really quickly.
Is Illustrator, does that get its own like .aic files?
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the stuff about using the Apple Pencil to draw paths and adjust paths and making that easier than doing it with a mouse was completely fascinating, because every time I try and deal with any kind of path, like I've used Illustrator a handful of times, and every time I get anywhere near those little anchor points and like twitch my hand, the whole drawing just like explodes in front of me.
I used to do a lot of Adobe Illustrator, and it is all about having your hands on the keyboard, and there's like two or three or four different modifier keys that you're always pressing to switch between modes. But on the iPad, it's like a row of buttons that you tap with your second hand.
There's like a touch modifier, which they also have on their other apps, and it's like the equivalent of holding down the shift key. And so they acknowledge that Illustrator has a huge learning curve, and it's just like mystifying to like learn how to use it. And it's easier on the iPad because when you press, when you tap like the pen tool, it opens up like a contextual like subtool menu, and it just knows like what the next move you're going to do is. It's like, so you drew a path and it's like you want to like remove these points, and it's like all you got to do is like click on it, and it just automatically knows.
Yeah. So Illustrator to me, every time I try to use it, I'm like, I don't know enough math to draw at this point in time.
Like, it is the most frustrating app for me. Like, I don't understand it at all. But iPad, it looked easy.
Yeah, so this is the opportunity, right? Yeah. They're going to rethink all these interfaces on this place. They're going to cut down the feature sets and build them back up around new interface paradigms. I think the hard part is, again, in the context of, can you move your work to this other place, to this other kind of computing? They have to get, I mean, Photoshop, it has like the Microsoft Word problem where every feature is important to 25 people and it's mission critical to 25 people. Right. And those 25 people are very important. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, like it's a long road to catch up to that.
We actually don't have time for it in the Vergecast, but OneNote just ran into this problem. They've reverted and they're going to continue developing the old version instead of working on the new good one that they made. It's a whole mess, and it's because of this 25 people problem. Anyway.
So I want to talk about one other announcement, and then I want to talk about Sneaks, because Sneaks are really fun. Mm-hmm. But they're building two features into sort of the video world. One, Premiere Rush can now publish directly to TikTok.
Okay, yeah.
Which is like Premiere Rush is like adorable, like just as a concept. Like, what if we made an iMovie that was different?
Yeah.
Fine. But it can publish directly to a social platform.
I love Premiere Rush. Don't be mean.
I think it's
important. You love clips.
Yeah. I mean, sorry. But
Dieter's like a bad video editing tool. I'm in. Anyway, so they're publishing directly to TikTok, and then they're building like the ability for you to live stream directly into their apps, which seems wild.
Yeah, so that is still in beta. Right now they're exploring it with Fresco. So you can just like press a button to go live, and then it generates a link for people to like click on, and they can like write comments on it. And
wait, so it's not live on like Twitch or YouTube?
No.
It's live inside of like the Adobe ecosystem?
Something like that.
What?
It's still very new, but they're thinking about bringing a built-in live streaming feature into Creative Cloud apps. So maybe one day in the future, it's like you could press a button to go live from Photoshop, and then people will be able to like follow along and see what you're doing. But they're doing this with like a learning component. So they do this thing right now called Adobe Live, and it's on Behance. And it's like you can just watch an artist work for like 3 hours at a time. And some streams have it so you can actually see which tools they're using at that time. And it's like a tool timeline. So it's like, oh, they cropped this. They made this selection here. And it's just done with the purpose of like learning step by step how this piece was created. So it is going to be really helpful for designers because that's how you learn, basically. It's like more helpful for, it's more helpful than art school. You know, it's like whenever you want to learn a new skill, you just go on YouTube. But this is the like Adobe equivalent of that.
Yeah, that's like the really interesting part of this is they're aware. I think Adobe is super aware that there's a generation of creators who are coming up on their products. And at teaching them to use their products and specifically their products and like building a full ecosystem around them from like literally learning how to use it to publishing directly to TikTok. I mean, it's just brilliant. It's, yeah. I can't tell if it's evil. Yeah.
Scott Belsky said that it's like what Twitch did for gamers. He wants this to do for artists. So they know that their products are like really hard to use and you could... it would take literally like hundreds of thousands of hours to like learn how to use it. And that's why like that's why Adobe Live exists, so people can learn to use their products.
Yeah. I mean, and they are hard to use, but like they should be because they're very powerful.
Yeah.
Like I don't think this is an argument to like cut down how hard they are.
Right.
I
just
think
it's just that, like you can do a lot with it.
But there are competitors and I like Affinity exists. Luma Fusion, is that the video one? Procreate is really good.
Procreate is super powerful, yeah.
Procreate, I would imagine, is way more popular than anything Adobe does for artists on the iPad, right?
Right, people love Procreate. It's only like a $10 like one-time purchase, and it's super powerful. And they're going to bring the ability to import Photoshop brushes into it. And they're bringing animation. Or, like they have animation already, but they're going to bring it to Procreate 5, which is like the next version that's coming out. So... yeah, like, I don't know, like maybe Adobe should be afraid of Procreate.
Well, so I guess like, I saw Affinity like is doing a 50% off sale like this week, right? Like there's competition now for these apps that have kind of been the only things you can use on the iPad. You were saying like Figma's in danger. Like is Adobe so big that it's going to run over this like little indie creator scene on these on the iPad in particular?
I don't know. Well, Figma is... it's interesting. It's like a fairly new company, but a lot of like huge companies, I think like Slack and Dropbox have like moved their entire teams over to it. And like, I think it also has like a free plan. So like anyone can basically like use Illustrator like for Illustrator tools like on the web. So it's got its advantages. I don't know if like Adobe XD adding like a co-editing feature is going to like ruin Figma. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of scary that they have modeled that feature after Figma.
Does Figma said anything about it? Because usually small companies like do a bunch of like subtle subtweets.
Yeah,
you get that nice snarky tweet.
Yeah, welcome Adobe. Really?
Oh yeah.
The surest sign that Microsoft is about to like
who
destroy.
Said that?
Slack just said it about Microsoft Teams. The first one was Apple ran it about IBM when IBM put out a personal computer. Steve Jobs ran welcome IBM.
Okay. Okay.
You will note that IBM went on to dominate the Macintosh. Then there was one that was Welcome Apple, and I think that was about streaming services. And then Slack just ran the Welcome Microsoft about Teams. I'm not saying Figma has done this. I'm saying there's a long tradition of greeting your giant competitor by welcoming them, only to have them like come into your house and destroy you.
Has any executive in the history of tech ever said a rising tide lifts all boats and been in business 5 years later?
No, definitely not.
Okay.
Right. This big company has validated the market and people see that we have a superior product. Like that's like you should just start. You should get on LinkedIn that day if you work at that company. I don't think that's going to happen. This ecosystem of smaller competitors on the iPad. One, people have already bought the thing.
Yeah.
So they've got the apps on their computer. Two, Photoshop just isn't there yet.
Like feature-wise?
Yeah, like it's not a full competitor yet.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing is it's only included as part of a Creative Cloud subscription. So I don't think this is going to be the thing that gets people to sign up for a Creative Cloud account. It's just for people who already have Photoshop, and it's just like an added benefit.
Yeah. Hmm. And that's like, Paul, to your point about Creative Cloud, like it does take over your computer. It's a big app now, but it's also like a lifestyle.
Like, it's a like, personality.
Yeah, it's like, I've got a Creative Cloud membership, and you've like got all the apps, and you're like, one day I'm going to use Adobe XD. I'm going to make that website.
That's me. Like, I just download stuff in the hopes that maybe I'll learn to use it someday, and it's just, like, sitting in my computer.
Yeah. You got all the icons there. They're all in a row.
It looks nice.
Do you see the one person who tweeted us that was, like, the Photoshop icon is round X?
So that, actually, there's a reason for that. It's like...
Wait, can I just tell people... All the app icons on the Mac are squares, and the Photoshop icon is rounded off, and it looks, if you notice it, you will never unnotice it.
It got, it graduated to a rounded
edge. Graduated.
I mean, that's, because the explanation is that once the app becomes cloud aware, was the word they used, they become rounded.
Oh my God.
That is the most subtle thing. I love it. It's incredible.
That's ridiculous.
All right, let's talk about these sneaks, because the sneaks are based on something else Adobe is doing, or most of them, which is they have their own AI platform called Sensei. Mm-hmm. I'm unclear whether Sensei is like one AI platform, like a singular AI that is smart, or whether it's like branding for all their efforts, the way that like Watson is at IBM.
Yeah, I'm not really sure either. They just call it their AI platform, and it's part of like features like content-aware fill in Photoshop, where you do like a circle around something that you want to remove, and it just like takes it away. And it just showed up a lot in most of the sneaks. And I think, let's see, what's one that was pretty good?
There's one. The key.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
There's one called All In, where it's for those moments when you're trying to take a group photo, but the person who's taking the photo like wants to be in the group photo. So it's like you take two photos, like one without you and one where you're in it, and then the AI kind of like pieces the two photos together, so you're kind of like everyone's like in the photo together.
Yeah, so you know,
it's like it's a Vanity Fair mode.
Yeah, no, it's like AI compositing.
Yeah,
you need a magic wand, the AI is going to do it for you. So I mean, that to me is like these products aren't real yet, right? Like that's the John Mulaney, everyone's having a drink, check it out. We're like compositing you in the photo, but they're saying Sensei. I mean, it's already there. In, like content aware fill is already in Photoshop. Sensei is all over Lightroom. Like you can like search for faces and things already. But it seems like the next turn for them is we're going to start doing a lot of stuff for you. Mm-hmm. Was that a sense that you got from them, or is that just we're seeing it kind of on the outside?
They've already kind of acknowledged that this work is really powerful, but they don't want to like scare creatives into thinking like we're going to take your jobs. Instead, they're trying to make it so that, oh, we're going to get rid of like the tedious tasks for you and like make it really easy so you can have more time to be creative. But I also think they're kind of starting to realize that the stuff they're unleashing into the world could have like very negative consequences. So they also previewed this feature that tells when a photo has been manipulated. So it gives you the probability that like these pixels have been moved and shifted around. So that also is kind of related to this new initiative that they brought up. It's content authenticity initiative, and they're doing it with Twitter and the New York Times. And there's not really a lot of details about it yet, but it's just like a thing that they're acknowledging. It's like, hey, we kind of have this role and like responsibility now to acknowledge that this stuff is really powerful.
I like the manipulation detection, which is like effectively like people in forums being like, I've looked at a lot of shops in my day and I can tell by the pixels that this is. It's like, yeah, we can do
but,
that.
But I mean, it's great that Adobe is making the tools to alter photos so you can't tell. Then it's making the tools to tell if the photos have
been
altered.
They're in arms race with themselves.
Sides of it. Yeah.
It's great. There's a real duality inside of Adobe.
I just realized that this like image verification thing that they're doing with the New York Times and Twitter is like the end of this story is someone who's going to do watermarks, but it's blockchain.
Yes.
Like that's just coming for all of us.
So, okay. We do not know what is happening with this. I can rant and rave about this all day and all night, but we don't know any details. So I will cut myself short because we're going to find out what is actually happening. I just don't think there's two ways to authenticate anything. One is to like have a server and a certificate and then like ping the server and say, I've got this hash. Is this the right? That's like the number one way that you do it. That's how everybody does everything. Once you do that, you can say, don't display the image, and you've got DRM. Like, that's how DRM works. Like, hey, I've got this content. Can you authenticate it?
Yeah.
Okay. The other way is to do some, like, crazy-ass blockchain shit. Those are your two choices. And I just don't think Adobe and Twitter are going to do some crazy-ass blockchain shit with images.
Right.
I don't think New York Times could put all of its images on the blockchain. it's going to pull you towards the server. Once you've got an authentication server, it's like, okay, I'm done now. We'll find out. Once you have an authentication server, you have the beginnings of a digital rights management platform.
The two things that the sneaks that I was most interested in were the video framing tool and the Photoshop camera, but especially the Photoshop camera. Like that thing looks amazing.
Yeah, it's basically Lightroom for people who don't know how to use Lightroom, and that's like me. So if I have a photo, it just tells you based on what's in the subject. So it's like, oh, I took a photo of some bibimbap. It's like this. That's a food, by the way. It's like, okay, the AI knows that it's a picture of food, so it'll do like the right filters for the food. Or it's like you can add like a bokeh effect so the AI will identify the subject and it'll just like blur out the background like on its own. So you can also create filters for it. So you can make a filter in Photoshop and somehow that gets onto the Photoshop camera app. I'm not really sure. I haven't tried it out yet.
That to me is, you know, what they haven't done yet, I don't think, has like formally created the sort of like preset store.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is sort of a secondary economy of like Lightroom presets for mobile. It sounds like you could do a bunch of Photoshop camera presets.
Yeah, that's a good point, because like people are already selling Photoshop brushes on Gumroad.
Yeah.
So maybe in the future people will be able to buy like filters for a Photoshop camera.
Yeah. They're probably just trying to figure out ways to avoid the Apple tax.
I want the LiveJournal aesthetic Photoshop filters. Do you remember the LiveJournal look?
like, you're on your own, buddy.
No, I've been on LiveJournal. I had a LiveJournal.
Like, okay, so you're making a strip of photos of like all your favorite Twilight characters, but you have to it was before Instagram filters are just the appified version of what the LiveJournal aesthetic. And you know what? Never mind.
I feel like we've just learned an awful lot about how you spend your time. So you know what's really interesting? We obviously just had the podcast last week with Instagram and the Pixel camera team, and we were talking about how their looks affect each other. The Lightroom auto button since the iPhone XS came out has radically changed how it works. It now pushes highlights way down and shadows way up. So it makes raw photos look more like iPhone photos in a way that it didn't do before. And so like this like Photoshop camera, like Lightroom, for people that use Lightroom, they're now going to be in control of like a look. Like a very obvious look that happens. And it's funny because I've noticed the auto button in Lightroom has like subtly changed. It's like, what if this photo is a lot flatter, like your phone? Which I just think Adobe as a creative company is probably less interested in having a defined look of its images.
They were saying how they think that like the camera improvements and all these new phones, it's just like, it's just happening so fast that they think that they could do software better than these platforms, that better than like, you know, Google Pixel phones or like iPhones. So I think stuff like the bokeh effect, it's like that could be really useful for people who don't have the latest iPhone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one feature of Lightroom that I've never understood on a phone is that it's also a camera. Like I don't love that the image editing app and the camera app are the same.
Yeah. You know,
it's like it's just a whole thing inside of Lightroom that I've never understood. I could talk about Lightroom all day long. I have a difficult relationship with Lightroom. It's a monopoly.
Yeah.
I'm going to pay for Lightroom for the rest of my life. So last question about Adobe, because we are talking about this company. And I'm really happy you went. I'm really happy you're on the beat. I think it is an undercovered company. It's so important to this entire ecosystem. And it actually doesn't get covered as, I don't know, critically as we cover Apple or Facebook or whatever. You come out of Max. You've been talking to a bunch of people there. You're talking to the creators. What is the vibe around Adobe? Is it... It just seems more mysterious than other companies we talk about.
The vibe of like the people who are there, or
yeah, I mean, do people love it? The vibe is electric. They're cheering for Content Aware Phil, but like it seems like people have a very up and down relationship with this company and its products.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the people who are there are only there because their companies paid for them to be there. So these are people who don't have to think about paying $10 a month to the company because it's already provided to them by their companies, which is sort of like the situation I'm in, you know, with Vox Media. And it's only online that you see like all these criticisms that, you know, you shouldn't be charging $10 a month. Like that's way too much for a service that is, you know, only $10 like for a lifetime of Procreate or Affinity. I'm starting to see a lot more tweets from people being like, this is it for me. Like, I'm soaring off Adobe now that I have all these other alternatives. So I do think maybe we'll start to see more of that happening.
Yeah. To me, it feels like to switch to an iPad, they needed Photoshop on the iPad. Like, Apple needed Adobe to make this product. And they finally relented, and that's going to open up a wave of conversations about this set of tools that is otherwise sort of under-remarked upon. Is that a phrase, Peter? Under-remarked upon?
It is now.
Okay.
You're playing a dangerous game when you decide your business model is some sort of lock-in. Because if people find the key, and that key is a free app called DaVinci Resolve that works on Linux, you know, like, all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow. Like, goodbye, handcuffs made by Adobe.
Wow.
I don't think that a free app that works on Linux is the thing.
Historically,
that's
not the thing.
Adobe. Just pretty sure.
You lost me.
Go on YouTube and look at all the. I left Adobe Premiere for DaVinci Resolve. Just search that on YouTube. There's a million people.
A million.
A million. At least.
It's like 25 people. Yeah, I mean, look, that's what fundamentally what I'm excited about is this was a moment to be like, okay, we're covering the hell out of Adobe. Here's 95,000 stories that they're going to produce and new products and new features. I think the goal is I want to track them as carefully as we track these other companies, because you're not going to get a bunch of people shifting their primary computing platforms if Adobe doesn't take them there. And that's, to me, is remarkable.
I mean, I have a whole story about this, which we could talk about after the ad break.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. Here's the story of innovation told in 5 words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and, of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Click, click, click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva.
All right, Dieter.
Yeah.
Surface Pro X.
X, not 10. X.
Yeah.
By the way, I tweeted this. What does X mean in Microsoft world? There's the Xbox. There's the Xbox One X. There's Windows 10 X. There's the Surface Pro X. And near as I can tell, all those X's mean different things.
In my opinion, unless you're Apple and you explicitly tell me it's pronounced 10, I think X stands for extreme.
Mm. Yeah. Expanded. Enhanced.
Extra. I don't know. Can you spell the word disappointing with an X? Because that's how I feel about the Surface Pro X.
Oh, boy.
X-appointing.
X-appointing?
Yeah. We're going to do an entire long extra podcast on this. I've got Tom, who has the Surface Pro X, and also Dan, who has been testing the other services. We're like going to talk about this for God knows how long pretty soon. And so I don't want to go super deep on this. I just want to say 2 things. Surface Pro X runs ARM, and I love it. It is the prettiest computer. I think it is way, way better looking than an iPad. And if you can find only ARM apps for it, you can get incredible battery life, and it's fast and it's great. But those apps don't exist, and so you end up having to use emulated apps, and then it's slow and gets bad battery life. And you can't run Lightroom at all, and that is why I bought it and then returned it.
The end.
Twice.
Twice?
Wait, I bought it ahead of time, and I was like, no, this is a bad idea. I'm going to cancel it. And then I was like, but what if I got it anyway? And then I did it again, and then I canceled it, and then the review unit came, and then I discovered that you just can't install Lightroom, and I was like, thank God, and then I bought a Surface Pro 7, and I'm happy.
Have you tried using Lightroom on the web on it? That's the ultimate hack, is to get that computer.
Lightroom on the web is fine.
Yeah.
For web stuff, yeah. Like, I do that on Chrome OS all the time.
Yeah. But I'm saying that the ultimate move to kill the battery life on a Surface Pro X is to install Chrome.
yeah,
and then use Lightroom on the web in Chrome, and then that's so, like 25 minutes and you're done.
There's clearly a pain knob here controlled by app incompatibility.
Yeah.
How far would the pain knob have to be turned down for you to buy a Pro X a third time?
If they made Lightroom available, even emulated, I would probably do it.
Wait, wow. So explain the... So we had Panos on the show, and he mm-hmm. said to me and Tom, our team has done an amazing job with emulation. Anything you yeah. want. iTunes and Chrome, those are the bellwethers. We got them.
They do.
But what? Where are the breakdowns? Like, why do the breakdowns exist?
So there's two kinds of ways to make an x86 app. There's make a 32-bit app. And if you use Mac, you know that a bunch of 32-bit apps stopped working in Mojave, right? So the new architecture is 64-bit, which is better in ways because there's more bits, whatever. It's better. They can emulate 32-bit using what I forget what it's called. And those run better than you expect. But I didn't expect muck, but they run okay, but ARM 64 cannot emulate 64-bit x86 apps. So if an app doesn't have a legacy 32-bit version hanging around or hasn't updated to 64-bit, then you're fine. But a bunch of apps are like, oh, well, we're just going to make the best one. We're going to make the good one that runs the best, and that's a 64-bit one, and we're not going to bother maintaining the 32-bit one. And so the best, most forward-looking Windows apps don't work.
That seems a little upside down. Isn't yeah. the whole point of the best, most forward Windows apps that they're processor agnostic, right? That they're modern. Is it easy to port from Intel 64 to ARM 64?
I'm not a developer. I don't know. I think that for some apps, especially like the UWP apps or like whatever, it is relatively easy to port. In fact, UWP should just work in 64-bit ARM natively across most of these in the first place. So for relatively simple apps, I think it's pretty straightforward. But for apps that like directly like need to talk to the GPU or directly do processor stuff, I do not think it's a simple transition to go from x86 to ARM. You can't just like check a box to compile to ARM and you're done.
So is this just a bunch of weird Microsoft decisions coming home? Right? Because the UWP as a platform is a mess.
It is one more decision in a chain of decisions that Microsoft has made since let's just go, how far back do you want to go? Let's go back to Windows RT, where the Microsoft says, you know what, we've really got to get off of this classic, you know, Windows NT code base. We gotta move the world forward. Here's the new kind of Windows. Please make apps. They did that with RT. They did that with, Windows 8 doesn't really count, but they started to mess around with like what Metro turned into. Then there was S mode. I'm probably forgetting something somewhere. And now there is Windows on ARM. And I just think there's just a lot of developers that are like, why would I take a flyer on Microsoft's latest attempt to get us to try a new version of Windows that's wacky? Like, I'll wait and see what happens. And I don't, it's a totally rational decision.
Apple's version of this is like, we're going to be harsh but fair. Like, we are absolutely doing this new thing, which, now that we're seeing this ARM laptop from Microsoft, it makes more sense like why Apple wouldn't do this yet, because they can't say for certain that this can be the future. I could imagine Apple saying, we aren't going to release ARM laptops until we know we can do all ARM laptops and give sort of developers like an end of life on Intel stuff.
Right.
Whereas Microsoft is clearly not certain what the future will be.
Well, one question I have, I'm also not a developer, is like whether ARM 64 emulating Intel 64 is just a hard limit. Like you just can't do it no matter what what operating system you're on, or that's a Windows problem.
Everything's possible. If a Turing machine can simulate another Turing machine, you can do Turtles all the way down, and you could do anything if you wanted to. It's just how much of a performance hit. Like there are certain like x86, emulating x86 is really efficient. you can do that. Like, so there are things that are going to be faster and slower, but it's definitely not impossible.
Right. So, I mean, Apple has we'll use Photoshop as an example. They can't put out an ARM laptop and then be like, here's this weird version of Photoshop that doesn't have a magic wand. People are just going to want to run Photoshop on their fun new ARM machine. And that's just the end of that question. Like either that works or it doesn't.
Yeah.
Right. And I think Microsoft has decided, well, what if some stuff doesn't work? Dieter, you described it as a CEO's computer. And I just want you to unpack that a little bit.
If you only use Office and you never need to edit a photo and like you can afford to have the little people do the hard work, then you're going to love this thing. It's also a CEO's computer because only a CEO can afford it. Like you have to spend like there's a $1,200 version with the keyboard, which you shouldn't get. Like the good one with 256 gigs of storage is like $1,800. And if they had just re-released the Surface Go with an ARM chip in it, I might actually be interested in it because like $600, it's a little bit slow and it doesn't run all the apps, but it's $600. Like, yep, sign me up. I will experiment in this wacky future with you. But $1,800, like that is just way too much money to take a flyer.
So what the other interesting thing, and I know you're going to do a whole thing with Tom and Dan on it, so we don't have to keep drilling at it, is this is the same but nicer form factor than the Pro 7,
yep,
which can just do everything.
Mm-hmm.
But a year from now, they're going to put out the Neo, which is the big dual screen, like Windows 10X computer that runs Intel. And it seems like the big form factor shift would have been a great time to do a processor shift and say, you need to rewrite your apps for this new dual screen paradigm.
You know what would happen, though? The dual screen one would fail. I think the stakes are too high for the Neo from Microsoft to risk not having the apps for it. So they have to go with Intel because they know that if they don't, it will absolutely bomb.
Wow. I mean, it's tough. All of that seems very hard.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Super hard. I'm happy I'm not in charge of solving this problem. And we've seen Microsoft try to solve this problem over and over again. Remember when they threw money at the Windows Phone problem?
Yes.
They just like paid developers just make apps? Like, I could like sit here and like make the list of things I wish Microsoft had done to make more ARM apps available on this computer, and literally everything I could think of, like Microsoft has already tried it and it hasn't worked. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean the main thing they tried was just paying people. Yeah. And they can't like pay Adobe. Like what's Adobe's like, whatever, we got $10 a month from everyone forever.
They could pay Adobe.
But then I don't know. Could they?
They could pay Adobe. Yeah.
The next time we get Scott, we're gonna be like, how much does it cost to make a Windows app? Okay, so can we talk by the way, you brought that up, so now I'm thinking about it. Can we talk for 2 seconds about Bill Gates saying we'd all be using Windows Mobile if not for antitrust in the 90s? I don't even know how to unpack. So Bill Gates is on stage with Andrew Ross Sorkin at the New York Times Dealbook Conference, and he says, I took my eye off the ball because of antitrust. It was my mistake, but if I hadn't done that, we would all be using Windows Mobile instead of Android, which he has said to me on this show in a slightly different way before. This is the most directly that he said it.
Yep.
But this is what I wanted to ask you about, Dieter. He said we were 3 months away from a Motorola deal that would have changed everything, and we were just too late. That, if I have my timeline correct, and I think his timeline's really wrong, that would have been the deal, the Droid deal on Verizon.
So
the deal that killed WebOS.
I really wish that you hadn't brought this up on the Rogecast because like this is my big reporting project is somebody inside Verizon was playing Microsoft, Palm, and Google off of each other for like 6 months, keeping like them all on the hook, thinking that they were going to be able to be the big iPhone competitor killer because the storm had clearly failed. Like
the BlackBerry storm.
Verizon, yeah. Verizon had anointed the BlackBerry Storm, and it was a disaster of a phone.
The only person who liked the BlackBerry Storm was Paul Miller, who thought, I believe in a review, said, this screen is great.
A brief hands-on demo. I was misled into liking the BlackBerry Storm, and I have repented for that many times on this Vergecast, as you are well aware.
Yeah, but now both Microsoft and Palm CEOs have said, well, if we had gotten the deal that Verizon said they were going to give us, then we would be Android today. So I want to know who in Verizon is like that, just that stone cold Machiavellian manipulator that had all three of these companies in like competing, you know, meeting rooms.
Lowell McAdam, their phones. The genius who also launched Go 90. It's a real hit or miss situation in Verizon.
Okay. But doesn't the BlackBerry Storm kind of disprove that a little bit? If Verizon's such a kingmaker and they put their Verizon cash behind a prospective king from a vaunted smartphone manufacturer, the smartphone manufacturer, BlackBerry, and that failed, it kind of does matter how good the thing is, right?
It does matter how good the thing is. If they had put all their money behind Windows Mobile, I don't know that it would have succeeded. I do think that if they put all their money behind Palm, behind WebOS, of course, it would succeed.
Absolutely.
WebOS was the best thing ever.
Of course you think that. No, here's what I'll say. Bold proclamation. Windows Phone, WebOS, and Android at that time were all as good as each other.
Yes. Although at that time, Windows Phone didn't exist. It was still Windows Mobile.
It was bad.
Which was bad, but was more capable. And if they had just had a, I don't know, they could have fixed it in theory. They didn't. And I don't know that they absolutely could have. But I will say that it turns out that Microsoft employed a lot of people, not just Bill Gates, and they were trying to and couldn't. So I don't think Bill Gates' attention would have solved that problem immediately.
Also, Bill Gates wasn't the CEO at the time.
And also, Bill Gates was making bad UIs at the time. He wasn't the CEO either. Yeah, like there was a whole lot of things that weren't doing well back then.
Yeah. It seems, I would say that quote is very interesting. He was probably half joking, because he was half joking when he said a similar thing to me. But that timeline's real messy. And also, David Pierce beat me to this tweet. If your argument is that antitrust regulation is the reason we're all using Android instead of Windows Mobile, like that is the best argument for antitrust regulation I've ever heard in my entire life. Like, yes, you created the opportunity for a new competitor to come in with a much better product than Windows Mobile. Like, yeah, break them all up. Let's just go nuts. Yep. Let's see what happens. This reminds me of another quote, by the way, of this time, which is when along the lines of Welcome Apple, Vic Gundotra, when Microsoft bought Nokia, he just tweeted, "Two turkeys do not make an eagle," which remains one of the most esoteric burns I've ever heard in my entire life. And I think we should all talk about it more often.
And accurate.
He invented that saying?
No, I think it's like one of these like weird sayings that like European wireless carriers used to say to each other all the time. Like European executives like wander around like dissing each other's mergers by saying, "Two turkeys don't make an eagle." Oh. And he like pulled it back out to like say it again. But like I had never heard it before because I was like
beautiful.
A baby reporter.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? And like literally people would pull me aside at conferences and be like, this is a famous saying from a 1947 merger between Siemens and a tire manufacturer. What are you talking about? Okay. Do you want to talk about Ignite for a couple minutes and then we can move on?
Just a couple. It's Microsoft's big enterprise conference. And you think, Microsoft IT enterprise conference, snore. But no, they announced a ton of shit. Like, here's the date for Edge going, here's a release candidate and here's when it's going to be official, Edge Chromium. Here's like a whole thing about Office. Now all the Android apps are just one Office app. Here's blah, 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 blah. They had a whole ton of stuff. And then they basically are pushing this idea of the Fluid Framework, which is like the cloud PSD. It's the new way that they want files to work, which is a proprietary thing in the cloud.
There's a very good quote on this. What if there was no more document? Instead, this is a canvas, and the canvas is smart.
I feel like that's just a great way of saying now you have to subscribe to your file system.
Probably. You need to unlock the full paid Office 365 for the canvas to be smart.
The problem is that they don't have good language for it yet. So they're trying to do to basically like Google Docs sharing, what Google Docs sharing did to like emailing Word attachments or like, floppy disk Word files, right? If you had a Word file, you'd somehow have to get that to somebody else and they'd mess with it and they'd have to give it back to you. And then you have to make sure you've all got the right versions or whatever. And the reason that Google Docs, when it first came out, was so innovative and so interesting wasn't the quality of the word processor or even the fact that it was on the web. It was that entire problem of dealing with files and which version of the file you have and blah, 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 blah. It just made it go away because like, here's the doc. We all work on the doc. When you open it up, it's always the right version, the most recent version of the doc. And if it's not, you can go back and look. So Microsoft is trying to go one step beyond that, but I don't know what the hell they mean by it there.
So yeah, so like the canonical document is like a URL. I think that's the what if there was no more document aspect, right?
Yeah.
Instead, this is a canvas, right? The canvas, you find the canvas because you know the URL. So you could drop this URL into a Slack and this canvas pops into the Slack and or probably Microsoft Teams and other people can see that, right?
This canvas drops into Slack and reminds you that Microsoft Teams is a superior product that's included in your 365 subscription.
Yeah.
But the canvas is smart aspect, I think, is kind of to do with like embeds. And I think it kind of makes sense why all the Office apps are merging. I think what Microsoft is doing with this is like, what if you an Excel spreadsheet, no more document. This is a canonical URL for an Excel spreadsheet was embedded in a Word document.
Are you going to say Olay Dieter?
And Apple, they have invented Apple's Open Doc.
No. You think that, but you're wrong because it's a canvas. You don't have to pick what kind of file you're using. Everybody can collaborate on it. You can chat next to it. Microsoft is trying to reinvent Google Wave.
Oh, wow. Yes. We all went three different Doom technologies. Dieter picked Google Wave. I picked Microsoft's doomed OLE. And you picked
I forgot OLE. Oh, my God.
It was pronounced Olay.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, the 90s are back. This is all a bunch of bad early 2000s, late 90s technology.
The last thing to say about Ignite is whatever hope you have, like the idea that Office is, I don't know, that they're pushing that onto the web. They're working way harder to make web apps happen than Universal Windows Platform apps happen. Like if the answer to this whole ARM problem is Microsoft just has everybody install PWAs or just like make, you know, Edge browser windows into apps or like, you know, whatever Microsoft's version of Electron might be someday. And it's not, we actually have apps in the Windows App Store. I think Microsoft would be fine with that. In fact, I think they're pursuing both of those tracks, and we'll see which one wins, is kind of, I think, what the strategy is.
You think this is why they moved to Chromium inside of Edge?
I think that Chromium is a much better app platform than whatever Edge was using, and they knew it, and they need to have some sort of hedged bet to be able to make web apps just in case. I do think that there's a little piece of this where Microsoft is trying to claw back a little bit of control of the web and control of how people use the web from Google. And Google's happy to let them because then they seem less like monopolist. And by the way, they're also using Chromium anyway, so hooray.
I love that we've now come to the point where Google's like, yeah, take some web market share. That would be good for us to Microsoft.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know. I think
that's exactly where we live.
That's just a bizarre time in history. Dieter, do you know what's going on with Electron apps in the Mac App Store?
No, it's very strange. So if you haven't heard, there are some Electron apps that were rejected because they were using private APIs. And so Electron just works by using these private APIs, you know, undocumented APIs, however you want to refer to them. And you're not supposed to do that in App Store apps, so they got rejected. And this is very odd because there are a ton of very, very, very popular apps that happen to be Electron apps like Slack that continue to be accepted. And so the big question is Apple making a grand new policy that it's trying to kill Electron apps to move everything over to Catalyst apps because those are great? Or, and then if so, are they applying those rules like capriciously and like letting the big guys in? So that's bad. Or is it like the bog standard, like an app reviewer like followed the letter of the law and they shouldn't have, and like they forgot the unwritten rule that you're supposed to let a bunch of apps through just because? I lean towards the latter, but there's been actually surprising little chatter about it. So I kind of think the latter is the case. But it's from where I'm sitting, it's still like a developing story as of today.
Well, I feel like if Apple was to ban Electron from the App Store, that's like a nuclear.
Yeah, for sure.
And they would have to be way better at Catalyst.
And they are not.
But you can see where it's going, right?
Which you could. If the Catalyst was any good or if Swift UI was any good, like there's a whole lot that's not good on the Mac. I hate to just quote my own tweets, but like the thing that's wild about the world we live in right now is when you use Windows and you run into like the old version of Windows, like the Windows 95 UI, like the three, you know, nested menus in deep in settings, you get annoyed. You're like, this doesn't look like Windows 10. What the hell? When you use a Mac, you get annoyed whenever you run into anything that's new. Anything that that Apple has tried in the past 3 years, you're like, what the hell is this shit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll see. All right. But you're going to do a long, deep dive on Surface stuff.
Yeah. We're going to talk all the Surface stuff, Surface laptops, Surface Pro 7, Surface Pro X. We'll probably talk a lot more about some of this Ignite stuff. Teaser, Tom Warren has been using the leaked ARM64 version of Edge and changes things a lot.
All right. So if we haven't sated you with this deep dive into Chromium trivia, that's coming up. All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Paul Miller.
Hello.
The consistency that holds our nation together.
Mm-hmm.
In a segment that is always called...
Uh-oh, we have a time hole.
It's not great.
So, a ton of people have received text messages that were originally sent on Valentine's Day. And this happening across a bunch of major U.S. carriers, right? So it's not just one-off technical glitch. So I have applied Occam's Razor and have I've also read Harry Potter. And in Harry Potter, the most magical, powerful magical force is love. The day of love is Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. So a time hole was created on Valentine's Day. And now the carriers are trying to cover it up, right? And so how are they going to cover it up? Well, guess what was announced 1 week or 2 weeks before? CCMI.
Oh my God.
Oh God.
Now, if anything has been made clear over the past couple of years about RCS, the carriers care nothing for our texting ergonomics or for RCS. So I think only the discovery of this time hole and an attempt to cover it up has brought the carriers together to create a new integrated conglomerate. I don't know what CCMI is, but they're going to work together very hard and they're going to provide us RCS in order to hopefully fix the time hole. But probably around February of 2020, we will, a great price will be asked of all of us to really heal the world.
I feel very strongly that I should apologize to the listener for saying this is a segment that holds America together. And then you immediately drove into Harry Potter, like no hesitation. Like you were like, yes, I hold America together. I've read Harry Potter. Mm. So for just an apology from all of us to you, the listener, but I think
that
you're right.
Divisive book series, Harry Potter.
I feel that you are. Well, it's more divisive over time.
Yeah.
If you want to make a hard left turn on Harry Potter, I'll go there with you. But I don't think that we should do that. No. I think you're right.
Okay, good.
But I think something else is happening. I think this is a breaking point for SMS. So Jake, like we noticed that all these text messages are coming. People are like weirded out. Jake talked to somebody who got a message from like a dead friend. That's horrible.
Yeah.
Really
we saw a bunch of people getting texts from their exes and then being like, I started chatting again. That seems different. My theory is that lots of people are faking it and just sending the U-ups and being like, oh, that was from Valentine's Day. I'm like over a decade out the game, but that's what I would do. Just put it out there. I was a bad person. All the carriers have like blamed each other now and blamed an unnamed third party texting provider.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but their statements, like both T-Mobile and Sprint are the only ones that have said anything, and they both have said this is resolved. Like we know that this happened and it's fixed now. It's like, or you could keep talking.
Yeah.
Like, tell us what the hell.
Tell us who this third party provider. So I think there's like some third party service that you've never heard of that your texts go through, which is already a problem. Did you know that Sprint and T-Mobile and AT&T and Verizon all just route your text through another company that you've never heard of?
You're completely unencrypted texts, by the way.
That's great. Mm-hmm. It's at Mark Zuckerberg's house. It's zucktext.com. He's just doing it for you. They need to break that contract. So they created a problem, and now they can tell this company that they're out of their like SLA agreement so they can launch their bad texting platform. That's my theory, Paul.
Okay.
It's more of a conspiracy theory than the world is. There's a love time hole, but that's my conspiracy much. Theory.
It's about the same. I mean, you may recall that I emergency ran out of the Vergecast 2 weeks ago to go report this story about the carrier consortium. I forget what CCMI even stands for, but all the four U.S. carriers are making a joint venture, a brand new company to make RCS a reality, and they're going to give you an app, which is just the worst timeline, Google's whole reaction has been like, "Hey, we're glad they're paying attention," which seems like positive but also scary. I don't know where any of this is going. My conspiracy theory is that SMS and RCS are like in a box, and you don't want to touch the box because the box is very fragile, and like nobody really knows how anything works, and so somebody walked up to the box like, "Oh, we got to get RCS going." And they like opened up the lid and that shook the box. And that's where all these texts came from. They like they shook the box that runs our SMS.
Well, so do the carriers not notice that a bunch of messages didn't go through on Valentine's Day?
It's odd, right?
It can't be a problem that happened today if the texts are from February. The problem had to have occurred in February. Mm-hmm. And then today, like the problem was fixed. Because they're not resends as far as we understand. These are texts that were delayed for a period of months.
Yeah. And
so for them to be like, "This is a problem, but we fixed it," it's like the problem is from February.
But like, do you think anybody anywhere in any of the carriers has any idea what is actually going on with SMS, which is a technology that was built to like work on like the transport, like meta communication layer?
Here's my question. How many people broke up on Valentine's Day because of texting going through?
I mean, was going to say, this sounds like a viral marketing stunt for a movie.
Yeah.
So they paid a bunch of random Twitter people to randomly tweet like, "Hey, this text, I didn't get it."
And we're going to find out tomorrow. It's like hijinks. Jake said most of his reporting on the story was making sure it wasn't a viral marketing stunt.
Yeah.
That was his
first
instinct. But he's now talked to many, many, many people. And if it is viral marketing stunt, more power to you. You've now convinced every news organization in the world that Sprint and T-Mobile suck. We should let them merge. That'd be great.
And if it is a marketing stunt and you haven't written the movie yet, please call it Time Hole.
Oh, how wild is it that it's like Valentine's Day? Like what? Why? How? Like Valentine's Day? That one? It's not like we're exactly 6 months away from Valentine's Day. Like, why not the day before? Why not 3 days after?
What if somebody used like a rare heart emoji and it gummed up the system?
It's horrible. All right. Two more things to talk about. Google's buying Fitbit for $2.1 billion.
Yeah. It's going into the hardware division.
Under Rick.
Who knows what's going to under Rick Osterloh, who knows what's going to happen to Fitbit software? They're adamant that you're going to be able to go delete your data if you're not comfortable with Google having it. They're adamant it won't be used for ads. The Wear OS people are like, "We look forward to working with Fitbit people," which is like the saddest.
Welcome, Fitbit.
Yeah. We need to do like three more Vergecasts for me to work through my emotions on this one. The bottom line is like, I would not expect anything to happen with this acquisition for like 2 years. Like, it's going to take him 2 years to like navigate this thing. Rick has done a good job buying other companies. He did a good job buying HTC, but this is going to take a minute.
2 years from now, is Fitbit devices better, worse, or non-existent? And then are Wear OS devices better, worse, or non-existent?
I don't know, Paul.
I have a slightly different theory. Google has to make a watch to complete its ecosystem that can compete with the Apple Watch. They have to. Like, the Apple Watch is extraordinarily popular. It sells a lot of units. People are wearing them. They now have, like, the $199 model, which is the, like, "I'm related to you and I need to buy you a present, but I don't actually know you. So here's this thing that looks like I love you." Like, that's a very important price point for Apple.
What is more important for that category, the AirPods Pro or the Apple Watch?
No, regular AirPods are in that zone.
Okay.
You only buy AirPods Pro if you really love someone.
Gotcha. Okay. That's great.
That's where I live.
Everybody.
It's the holiday season. And you can tell I'm thinking about this. Like, you can, if you get noise canceling, I know you. If you get the regular, it's like, you're great. You got my last name. Let's not overthink this. I'm going to be a great dad. But the watch is like critically important in that zone, right? Yeah. It's a great product. It works really well. It's integrated with the operating system. There's no denying that it is like a tremendous boon to Apple. It locks you in, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Google has nothing. They got a bunch of like weird fossil designs that like run a bad processor and they don't have flat tires. Like that's like the main thing. Like if you're interested in Android Wear, what you're really interested in is like a circle. That's your main design consideration in this product.
And you should just buy a Samsung's watch instead.
Yeah. So Google has to like finish their ecosystem because now people want to buy a watch that connects to their phone. Like if you buy a Pixel, you don't have like some great analog to the Apple Watch to go and buy. I think this is their move to do it. And Fitbit, because they don't run on hopeless Qualcomm processors, because they're good at health tracking, because they have like the social network of competition, all the stuff, Google can just like make it less ugly, make it so that it's easier to like action a notification on the Fitbit operating system connected to Android and just move the hell on.
Well, so that's the question. The number one question is, when Google makes its watch hardware under Rick Osterloh, are they making a Fitbit or are they making an Android Wear that uses Fitbit's hardware chops?
I think they're gonna. Why wouldn't you keep the Fitbit name? They kept the Nest name.
No, but well, is it going to use Fitbit OS? You know, there's 15 versions of Fitbit OS, but it's basically an RTOS. It's like pretty low, whatever. It's like based on what Pebble did, and it's not that powerful, right? It's not that extensible. Wear OS is very powerful, very extensible. Maybe Qualcomm will have a chip that comes. So did they buy Fitbit because Fitbit has a bunch of people that know how to make good wearables and then they're going to have them make a good Wear OS device? Or did they buy Fitbit and they're just going to like run out the clock on Fitbit's platform? But they're, you know what I mean? Like what are they going to make? Are they going to make a Fitbit watch or are they going to make a Wear OS watch?
Fitbit watch.
I could go either way.
Like why would you buy Fitbit if you didn't want their actual stuff?
Because they've got people that know how to make a watch. That's like it.
Yeah, I think they'd be foolish to walk away from like the more successful product in favor of their own not successful product.
Do you think they'll open source Fitbit stuff?
Who knows?
Yeah,
it's all very confusing. Like I landed on don't overthink it. Like Rick just wants people that know how to make a watch.
Yeah, just like you wanted
that was what the HTC acquisition was. Like, it was like, oh, what do they do with HTC? Do they want the blockchain phone? What's happening? Blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, he just wants people that don't suck at making phones. That's all.
Yeah.
The end.
And they can just do it themselves.
Yeah.
Like, we heard about the Pixel 3. Like, they just, like, did it.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Nest Pixel phone. Watch. Sorry. So the next, let me try that joke again. The Nest Pixel watch.
You're done.
Yeah.
That's it. OS. That's the broadcast, everybody. No, the last thing to talk about is, in fact, AirPods Pro. We didn't talk about them last week when they came out. I have them. I'm wearing them. Chris Welch reviewed them. Here's what I will say about them. They are the thing that AirPods should have been from the start. They sound fine.
I tried it out in the office, and having never worn noise-canceling headphones before, it was incredible. Like, our open office plan where you can hear, like, everybody talking about four different things all at the same time. Like, I put in the AirPods, and it was just like they all started whispering. That's what it sounded like. I was like, this is crazy. So I can never have them because if I wear them in public, I will die. I will get hit by a bus, and I will drop them onto the subway tracks.
Well, you can put them into the weird mode. Transparency mode. People are freaking out about transparency mode.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time on planes. Dieter, you spend a lot of time on planes.
Like, I do.
Noise-canceling headphones are how you survive life if you spend this much time on planes. And like my Sony ones have the bad transparency mode where you like cup your hand over your ear, which just makes you look like an asshole. Like someone's talking to you and you're like, I'm not going to take off my headphones. I'm just going to go like this. Every time I've tried it, I'm like, I apologize. Like, I tried this for the fourth time. Transparency mode does not feel that way to me.
Why don't you just take off the headphones?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But like Sony wants you to be like, you know, the flight attendant comes by and says what you want to drink. You're just going to go like this and you're like, a Diet Coke. And you're just like, I'm a horrible person. Like, there's no way to do that without feeling waves of guilt.
Transparency mode is for spying on people while looking like you're listening to music.
Yes. Right? There's a whole social construct around transparency. But normal AirPods, you can just hear everything. So, like, whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
I will say that the difference in transparency mode of like my Sony cans and these AirPods is very minimal. The AirPods Pro are a classic example of Apple taking a technology that has long existed and then being like, we invented it.
Yeah.
Like when they're like, when in their description on the website, when they're like, we add anti-noise to the noise, I'm like, guys, like literally Bose was doing this like 20 years ago. Like, what are you doing? But they're very good. They sound fine. I just want to put this out there. Deeply fine. They do not sound great. They're deeply fine.
Well, I haven't tried them yet. What's this thing with like, they're not as, because it sometimes bothers me in-ear headphones will have that seal, right?
Yeah.
Like, and there's, these have slightly less of a seal.
No, the seal is still there, but there's a vent so you don't have that weird popping feeling like when you put them in your ear.
If you have a vent, don't you have a, you don't have a seal anymore, right? I'm sure. Really confused.
So you, okay, so you need the seal for bass response. So you do have a seal, right? Okay. It's sealed, but there's a vent, so it equalizes the pressure inside your ear versus outside.
So while it wubs, it lets in air as appropriate so that it doesn't push on your
drums. So like the most amazing moment of AirPods Pro, like when you get them, you put in one. And when you put in just one, it doesn't go into noise canceling, it goes into transparency. So the mics are lit up and it vents. So you put in one and it instantly feels like you haven't done anything.
Yeah.
Which is like a remarkable feeling. And then you're like, wow, now I'm just a guy with a Bluetooth headset. Let me put in this other one. And then it goes into noise canceling. And then you're like sealed out. And that's like very cool. But the vent just is there to equalize the pressure and it works really well. I think they're great.
I don't know if it's the vent, but I will say that compared, I haven't tried the Sonys yet, but compared to like over-ear Sony noise canceling headphones, the AirPods are not effective at drowning out incredibly loud noise.
Yeah,
they make it slightly less noisy and slightly less annoying, but like it's still there. Like I'm talking about like on the train, right?
Yeah.
On the subway where there's like just horrific screeching at 95 decibels.
Yeah. Or a plane. So last week I flew to California and then I flew to Chicago and I was on a lot of planes last week.
Yeah.
And I gave up on the AirPods and I put on my Sonys.
Really?
They were way quieter. Yeah. They just can't roll with a plane. Like they're just, planes are real loud.
Yeah.
And the, putting something over your ears to block out even more, actually more effective.
I have purchased the most scary, it is going to find a way to transmit a virus, 3.5 millimeter Bluetooth transmitter I could find at Amazon. It's not like the one with the extra cable. It's literally just like a headphone jack with a thing stuck onto it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really excited to try it.
That thing's going to hack your car.
Yeah.
Just like straight up. It's going to like detect like this is a Honda Civic. I know how to hack it. Your car, you're going to get pwned by like the government. It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
No, I think they are very good. Like I said, I think they're actually great in terms of how they work. I think they are like proof positive that Apple's tight control of its ecosystem lets them do stuff that no one else can do, which is either great, and that's great, or it's horrible, right? Like I think the noise canceling technology in the Sony wireless buds is probably better because it's the Sony stuff, which is very good. They probably sound better depending on how you feel about how things sound. But there's no way Sony can match the pairing. There's no way Sony can match the battery life. There's no way Sony can integrate their controls right into the control center.
The control center.
That stuff, it's starting to border on, it's a little unfair.
Yeah.
I asked Apple, by the way, if they were going to roll any of their improvements to Bluetooth into the standard. And their answer was, So I'm just going to accept that as a no.
Yeah.
All right. That's it. That's the Vergecast. We did the whole thing. Dami, thank you for being here.
Cool.
I am very excited that we're covering Adobe this much. I think they're undercovered. Anyway, we have a bunch of stuff to tell you about. The week before Thanksgiving and the week of Thanksgiving, the Vergecast is going to go a little sideways. We're doing a big feature on pirate radio, which still exists. It's still vibrant. There'll be stuff on the site. We're actually going to print it as a zine in the spirit of like pirate radio. But Andrew, our producer, has been working on some special feature podcasts that we're going to run that week. There'll be three of them. The first one is about DJs in Afghanistan who work for the United States military, spreading military messages. We're profiling one of those DJs. We've got Hmong people who have a phone conference line that they just like play their own pirate radio on. So people just dial into a party line, which is hilarious. And the last one, we can't not yell at Congress on the Vergecast. So a bill called the Pirate Act in Congress that actually cracks down on pirate radio. And that actually is going to have ripple effects. So three special episodes the week before Thanksgiving. Tuesday of Thanksgiving week, and we're off for Thanksgiving, although we might have a little surprise in Black Friday. We'll think about it. We'll let you know. But I want you to know that's coming. I want you to look forward to it. It's going to be really fun. And I want you to buy our zine when we put it out. I'm very excited. It's our first print product.
Yeah.
It's a zine about Pirate Radio. The first episode of the Pirate Radio series is Tuesday the 19th, so stay tuned for that. I also want you to go listen to Reset with Ariel DeHaim Ross, former Verge reporter and at Recode, doing a 3 times weekly tech show called Reset. It's about a broad definition of tech. It looks at science, medicine, politics. It's out now. It comes out on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays. Go subscribe to that wherever you get your podcasts. Teeter, you want to tell them about Command Line?
It's a newsletter about computers. It comes out pretty much every weekday. Sometimes I write something longer in it. Sometimes I don't. But if you miss me tweeting opinions about tech, it's because it's all in the newsletter. So you should go subscribe to it, theverge.com/newsletters.
Also, I want you to check something out on our sister show, Today Explained. Sean Wamasarm and Vox critic at large Emily Vanderwerf are discussing the streaming wars, one of our favorite topics. Apple TV+, Disney+, HBO Max, and Peacock, which is NBC's entry. What it all means for the future of TV. They're calling the episode Streaming Explained. That's in the Today Explained feed, wherever you get your podcasts. And then you can tweet at us. I'm at Reckless. Paul's at Future Paul. Dieter's a backline. Dami, what's your Twitter?
Dami_Lee.
Perfect. All right, that's the Verge cast. We'll see you next week. Rock and roll.
Well, promo code.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.